yeah. It's a great pleasure to be here, and we already got some interesting motivation from Yatir to think in new ways about quantum mechanics. And I was very happy to find many connections, which I didn't think about yet, about the modular values and what I'm talking about. I have been looking for a long time now already at the statistics that come out of weak measurements. And I have been trying to make sense of what comes out, not just in the weak limit, but also when you go to stronger measurements. So I start by first talking a little bit about the relation between weak and strong measurements, and use that to introduce a new viewpoint about the role that causality actually plays in a measurement, and show that the complex weak values that we get out of measurements have a lot to do with a specific definition of the action. And since there was so much talk already about Lagrangian actions, this is not a Lagrangian action. This action is much closer to simply an area of phase space. So the Hamilton-Jacobi theory actually deals mostly with areas of phase space. But I found that dynamics can be understood much better if we formulate this action separately. And then I get a new viewpoint that is maybe this new intuition that we might be looking for, how classical realities emerge from quantum dynamics. And I've put all of this in quotes because the classical quantum distinction is then not quite right anymore. And maybe I can later explain that a bit more. So let me just start from where I come from. And I've made it a little bit provocative here. I've always been fascinated that we can see things in the laboratory. Now, I'm not recently doing experiments. I work with experimentalists, and we have done several experiments in cooperations. I'm not doing the experimental work, but I'm fascinated by the idea that we can actually see things in the laboratory, and I love to look at data. And I would say that we just know what physics is by looking at what happens in the experiment. To me, that is a way to know nature by touch and sight. And I find it difficult to abstract that so much. For me, if I don't know how I would see it, I find it very difficult to understand what it is. So what I like about measurement and measurement theory is you start with very well-defined conditions. Initial state, final outcome, and maybe you have a middle outcome here. So this is actually a very general view of what you do in a laboratory when you do a quantum measurement, and you also have a post-selection. You prepare a state, which means you do something in the laboratory to your system, to control your system. And then you perform an interaction also by the available fields, and there is an effect of that. You know this effect, and then you have a second effect, which you also relate back to the original system. So maybe I should use the hockey club. Okay, there is the uncertainty problem, and here I illustrate this a little bit. So we actually perform an interaction here, and something about this interaction is not fully controlled. So this interaction changes the physical property that is associated with the outcome. And that is basically our problem when the measurement is not so weak. That was the idea, we heard that from Yakia, that is exactly the idea that brings us to weak measurements, right? So if U changes B, then A has its reality before the interaction, B has its reality after the interaction, but they do not come together. Right? If this interaction is rather strong, we cannot just say, oh, B comes from here. and A continues until here. That is why we are using weak measurements, right? So in this context, I can just say this, we already all know about this. We can do a weak measurement, and that was fascinating to me. I studied a lot this form, because in this form, that is like a precise measurement of M, but we do it weakly, a weak projective measurement, and that looks like a conditional probability of getting M under condition A and B. And I call this here the weak statistical signature. I have boldly called it a complex conditional probability at other times. There's often a lot of criticism of that. But anyway, it's clearly the weak statistical signature that you get from this initial and final condition. So weak values actually describe objective relations between three strong measurements, A, M, and B. But since the middle measurement is a weak measurement, it doesn't actually have a joint reality with A and B either. So this is where I had a lot of discussion with people, and whenever I said this is a probability, people wanted to pin me down that I'm claiming that this is absolutely real, and I'm not claiming that. So I'm trying to be a bit careful here. No joint reality, weak statistical signature. However, very important, this is objective. The problem for people who want to be a little bit more on the instrumentalist side is that they cannot be objective about this measurement outcome. And that's precisely the criticism that people have about weak measurements, that because this is a weak statistical signature, there's so much noise in the actual measurement, you cannot actually say this is a property of the single system. But if you turn around, then you have to say that that's because the experimental result in the laboratory is not entirely objective. Do you want to say something, Lev?
You say three strong measurements, and then you say the intermediate one is weak. So I'm
yes,
curious.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Yes, what I'm saying here is the projector is also used for strong measurement. So what I'm saying or claiming here is that the projection operator is the correct representation of the strong measurement. And by testing the weak statistical signature, I get a relation between essentially three strong measurements. Strong measurement here for preparation, strong measurement here for outcome. And this is not a strong measurement here, but I can change the order. I can change the order around, and this can become a strong measurement. If I make any one of these three measurements weak, I can see the relation between the three. So here's the important point. I think we should explore the relation between things we cannot do jointly. The relation between measurements that cannot be performed jointly is important for physics.
I don't get it. If you change the order,
yeah,
you will have M and M on the outside, but then you will have...
No, not M and M. A, B, M, M, A, B.
Oh, so not the order of this expression for B weak.
No, no. Just the order of operations of how I operate on the system, yes. And that was actually the point I was always making. I come from quantum tomography, and in quantum tomography, we actually use a certain class of measurement to predict another class of measurements. Why can we do that? Why can we take completely different measurements and use the results from these measurements to predict a completely other measurement? That is because these are objective properties of the system. And physics is about the relation between objective properties. That is the Heisenberg picture, actually. So the Heisenberg picture is hovering in the background of this whole talk. Yeah, so. Then what happens in the strong measurement? If we actually do the strong measurement here, the difference is, of course, that we do have a strong interaction here. And that's what I said before. If we want to explore the relationship between all three strong measurements directly by performing strong measurements, now the order is really important, because this interaction completely randomizes what's coming out here. So we don't have a joint reality A and B, even so in the laboratory we have, because A and M have a joint reality before the interaction, and M and B have a joint reality after the interaction. So we have to understand what is happening here dynamically. And this is going to be a big point of my talk. I was initially hoping I could talk more about the experiments we did, because we did a lot of experiments where we changed the interaction strength from weak to strong. And then we show that all of these results are consistent with each other, because we can tell what this interaction does. It changes the resolution of this outcome, and at the same time, it changes the back action, which means the relation between A and B is changed at the same time that we change the reliability of each measurement. So we explored that experimentally in great detail. So what I'm talking about is maybe a little bit abstract now, but I have very good reasons from laboratory evidence to talk like that. And we find that this is a very understandable form of dynamics. That's important here. And I boldly say that my conclusion from what we found is that the dynamics here is a randomization along the orbit M. So this projector also has the function to represent an orbit generated by the interaction. And if it is a measurement interaction, this is a randomization of this orbit. This can be an eigenstate of a unitary or an eigenstate of an operator of measurement. And the reason why it's always the same mathematical form is that in the measurement interaction, the dynamics and the transfer of information is closely linked. That is what is the big thing in quantum mechanics, the really big change in quantum mechanics, that whenever we want to find out something about the system by interacting, we are also driving dynamics, and we cannot ignore the dynamics. I think I'm saying something that...
So, but orbit means something continuous, right? But is it discrete? So what is the
negative? Nothing changes. That's the nice thing. I'm doing this discrete because it doesn't really matter. The discrete form and the continuous form here are exactly the same.
What do you mean by ergodic?
I mean a randomization of dynamics. And ergodic theory from thermodynamics is that the ensemble average and the dynamic average are the same. Yeah. And it's the same thing I'm saying here, that this ensemble average probability you see here is actually a dynamically averaged probability. I will show that in more detail. This is actually an important point. How does ergodic randomization work? Right? So if you first want to do it without any controversy about how weak values work, you can actually just take the standard form. Ergodic randomization is randomization over time for specific dynamics. And then you apply it to quantum mechanics by taking some dynamics generated by a unitary. And this is a unitary with a fixed Hamiltonian with eigenstates m, right? So if you completely randomize the time, this is sufficiently long. I mean, I could take a limit to infinity. Then the result is a complete decoherence between the energy eigenstates or subspaces. Yeah? Is that strange or clear? So I guess some people who studied decoherence theory would be very familiar with that. Since you are eliminating the off-diagonal elements, it is basically the same as defacing. And the off-diagonal elements are eliminated because the complex rotating phases here are rotating. If the m's are the same, the phases here don't rotate.
You're assuming something about the spectrum.
No, it's not degenerate in this case. That's the only assumption. So in this form, I'm implicitly assuming it's a non-degenerate spectrum, okay? So this is a bit important. In this form, it should be uncontroversial, really. And people know that this is what happens when I do a strong measurement without readout. So now weak measurement gives us a great opportunity to elaborate that in detail and make it, yeah?
Yeah,
Justin?
Just before you go on, just to expand on Luis's point. You're assuming a non-degenerate spectrum, which gives you a rank one projector.
Yeah.
You assume a degenerate spectrum, you'll get a rank two, rank three, rank four projector, which will exactly match what you expect from the Luder's rule of projective measurement.
Right. That's actually absolutely correct. So thank you. Yeah. Here I go to an image that we have in classical ergodic theory, where we normally say we start from an initial condition, and we have an orbit, and we randomize along the orbit starting from A. Now, that we cannot do in normal formulations of quantum mechanics because we are not allowed to know both the energy and the starting point. But thanks to weak measurement, we can actually at least conceptually do that. And that's actually something we could measure using weak measurements. Ergodic theory says us one big result that the memory of the initial condition disappears by the ergodic averaging. That now happens also when we apply ergodic averaging in quantum mechanics using the concept of a post-selected condition or pre-selected condition, depending. So here, for example, we could post-select on the energy and prepare the initial condition. And then we could see that if we randomize the time at which we measure B, then the probability we get out does not depend on A anymore, and we get exactly the quantum mechanical prediction from the inner product squared. So yeah, we get Born's rule here simply from an ergodic average. And that's important maybe, yeah? So actually, if you know the history of quantum mechanics a little bit more, it's pretty clear that a lot of the wave functions look like ergodic averages, and then they have all of these interferences in addition. That can be explained better now, because there is now a way to do the same ergodic average, like in the classical ergodic averaging, using quantum mechanics. And here I have the form using the weak values, and it's easy to calculate, and it's all in this paper. So. If you want to have this in detail, that was just published in European Physical Journal D on the fundamental role of dynamics in quantum mechanics, or quantum physics maybe. There I go into great detail how these randomizations work. Yeah. What I find fascinating is this is really for me an intuition. So when I prepare a state, I'm driving it around an orbit. And the randomness that comes out in the end comes from the orbit. So, and this is a very important picture for that, because now we get a phase in that comes from the complex valued probabilities of weak measurements. And this phase is something that I studied for a long time. It has a physical meaning. First of all, in a phase space picture, this phase corresponds to the enclosed phase space area in this Hansen action. You have now three states, meaning three orbits, A, B, M. And what happens in the ergodic randomization of a projective measurement of M is that this dynamics is randomized. So you can go from this point to this point. In a weak measurement, you don't randomize here, and you get the statistical signature of all three points. And in classical physics, you would expect a zero if they don't all line up in one point. In quantum mechanics, this is what you get. And this very rarely goes to zero. You can see that only if this or this is actually zero, then this is zero. So. And then you can interpret this action, and you can use a unitary transformation to understand what this action is. It is a phase in a unitary transformation that optimally gets you from A to B. That is in 2011, New Journal of Physics. I explained that for the first time. I'm always a bit surprised that there is not more continuing work on that, because these are things you can measure. So. The phases we measure in the weak measurement statistics actually have something to do with optimal transformations. And experimentalists can do transformations, right? So this action is something you can realize in an experiment and control in an experiment. And we should really go in this direction and check that.
Now, some experiments have been done with optimizing the way that you go from the issue condition to time condition. When you
yes.
make measurements in the middle,
Okay, that would be good to connect with that because
yeah,
that's the general theory on that. Yeah.
So isn't that the Panchratnam case as well?
It's also called the Panchratnam phase. But here I'm giving a picture that also works in classical physics. Panchratnam phase is not normally associated with classical physics. I'm really getting to the classical action here. And this is where I bring in the action physics. I just want to give a bit of a reminder. The action as X expresses reversible transformation in physics. The reason why a unitary can be written like this is even in classical physics, you can describe a change in momentum simply by a differential of an action. So this is an important point. This is why geometric phases don't get you further, because you're using the wave analogy again. And here you should be using the analogy with classical dynamics. That explains something. So this expression exists in classical dynamics and also in quantum dynamics in exactly the same way. So Hilbert space phases can be explained by classical actions. And we can generalize basically here. In classical physics, the deterministic result for x under condition AB is simply a function of AB. And in the classical limit, the stationary action, but this is not a Lagrangian action, this is a stationary action of a classical transformation, deterministic transformation. If that is zero, the distance is zero. If the distance between two points is zero, you are at the same point. That is the classical limit. That doesn't quite work in quantum mechanics anymore. So the quantum phases are all classical actions. What do I mean by that? Well, when we write a state as a superposition, A as a superposition, M1, M2, M3, M4, right? We have intersections between orbits in my picture, right? So the inner product in Hilbert space now has an image attached, an intuition attached to it, which is the intuition of intersecting orbits. And we can represent A as a series of intersections with different M. That is what a superposition is. But it's intersections, it's not the whole orbit. So we cannot write A simply as a mixture of the orbits, because the orbits go all over the place here. So we need coherence. Why? Because we need to fix exactly how far along M we are when we cut across A. Okay?
Can you clarify what is orbit?
Well, orbit is just this randomized dynamics in the end. It's dynamics, right? So if you start at any point and then drive the dynamics and don't care where you are, the whole thing that is covered is the orbit. The whole history of these random dynamics, that's the orbit.
Minus infinity to plus infinity?
Ideally, but I've written about that in the paper, actually. Of course, it's realistically always a finite element, right? If you look at the experiment, you can actually figure out just how finite it is. It has a lot to do with resolution of your measurement. Ideally, of course, I can take the limit to infinity in order to be mathematically in a very nice Hilbert space. You have to think a little bit about how it goes together. Previously I showed you the graph of three orbits and the action they enclose, and of course this is a composite of these orbit intersection actions. So it's very important. The individual phase in quantum superpositions really tells you how far along the orbits the intersection is. That is the physical information, really. Right? And you can actually derive the form of energy eigenstates directly it's very similar to WKB, if you know about that. But you can do it even more directly simply from laws of dynamics. And the trick is, if you have a notion, maybe from classical physics, how the time from A to B depends on energy. If you have any notion from classical physics how the time it takes to get from A to B depends on energy, you can find the action of BAE. There are three physical properties, and you can find the action enclosed by these three physical properties simply from one relation between time and energy. And then you can very quickly find what the approximate form of the quantum state is. So if you only used a law of classical dynamics, and voila, here is the complete expression for quantum state, full coherence. I found that rather intriguing. You can just study the classical dynamics and then write down full quantum coherence of an energy eigenstate. I find energy eigenstate without ever writing down the operator. I can write down the operator, but it's not even necessary at that stage. So I've actually some students working on that because it's just so nice to do that and play with the action. Things change in time. That's the problem. If they were not dynamical, things would sometimes be easier. One connection I'd still like to make, especially because the operators are important, right? Is how commutativity comes into play here, because you might not be seeing that. Actually, the action I was showing has a lot to do with non-commutativity. And that comes out in the statistics we see in weak measurements. So if you have a Hamiltonian with eigenstates m, as before, then the time derivative of a probability is given by 2 over h bar, imaginary part of the weak value of the energy times the probability. And this directly leads to, in a sense, the well-known formula, only normally we write the commutation relation here with an I. I just call it imaginary correlation between B and H, because if you use weak-valued probabilities, that's the same thing. If you use the conditional probabilities that come out of weak measurements, you can directly measure commutation relations. Imaginary part of the correlation between two quantities. So we find that the notions I just developed are saying that dynamics and motion corresponds in some sense to an imaginary correlation. And the problem here is that instead of going from point to point in time, or instead of just changing the value of physical properties over time, we are now moving quantum mechanically along the orbit. And there is an element of non-locality here in the sense that we cannot just assign values at each point in time. We are stretched out somewhat in terms of the possible actions and possible effects that can happen. And this corresponds to an imaginary correlation between energy and the changing observable. You should ask yourself, can that be consistent with experience? The answer is it is totally consistent with experience, because these very small correlations are always covered by the uncertainties that happen because of interaction. For example, in normal objects, why is there an imaginary correlation here when I move this? Well, actually, I see this move because it scatters light. It scatters light and therefore always changes its momentum. And also, the position and the trajectory is not fixed. To see something move, you have to interact, and this interaction will change the motion. We forget this because we don't care about h bar. Only in quantum mechanics, maybe we should care about h bar because it's important. So we have to get the classical limit right, and we have not done that right yet. We are normally using a language that is totally inappropriate in quantum mechanics because it assumes that we could do things without interactions, we could just know things in our heads, and we wouldn't need to interact. So this is where the action becomes important, and one good way to look at it is to try to understand how things move as directly as possible. That's why this form is very useful here, right? So this form has a phase, and this phase can be immediately associated with an action. And this is also a classical action, namely the time derivative of this action to go from A to B in time t, now without the energy, is minus the energy it takes to go from A to B in time t. And in quantum mechanics, that's the real part of the weak value of energy. So here's the difference between classical and quantum. In classical mechanics, it's just the value of energy. In quantum mechanics, it's the weak value of energy. Otherwise, it's the same relation. So again, in many cases, you can sit down and do the classical solution and use it immediately in quantum mechanics. You can generalize it a little bit, and I recently did that in a work. You can see that the time derivative of the amplitudes have weak values in them, and the second derivative also has a weak value. This is important because here we have a real part of the weak value changing the probabilities. Right. So these relations can be used to describe the probability change when you change the time between measurements. That's very important. In a quantum measurement, you don't observe change over time. You run the same experiment over different times and then measure each time separately, because you just cannot look at motion without disturbing it. That is actually a natural situation in interference experiments, because in an interferometer, you change the phase and measure. But of course, for every measurement, you have one phase. You could think of it like a time evolution. And in quantum mechanics, it's really measured in the same way you measure a time evolution. You cannot measure the evolution of the Schrödinger wave because you cannot measure it without disturbing it. You cannot just measure it in the single system at different times. It doesn't work. And the interferometer is a kind of paradigm of that. You set the phase and measure, set a new phase and measure, but it is a phase dependence, right? And I looked at the multiphoton interference for several reasons. Basically, input photons, photon number is fixed, and there is an input photon number difference, and there's an output photon number difference. What is the phase dependence of the probability to go from A to B? And here, the differential equation that tells us the interference fringe we see is actually then given by the weak value of the photon number difference between the path to the square. So I can actually use very classical optics logic to derive the necessary intensity difference between the two arms, and I don't know which sign it is, plus or minus, from the initial and final condition. The interesting thing is, this gives me the action of the interference fringes, and this action is, in this case, a quantum interference. It's the quantum interference between the plus and the minus value of the difference in the interferometer in intensity. So we can get the weak value from classical causality quite directly. So the value of the intensity difference between the arms, so this is the J3, is determined by knowing A, B, and the phase. Right? So this is a function, if you know optics, it's very easy to calculate. And then you can explain the experimental results you get. For example, for 16 photons, it would look like this. This is the phase shift. You have an input of 8 photons, and an output, you have a photon number difference of 6, which means you have 11.5, right? So the probability of getting 11.5 photons out from the port goes like this. And you can determine what the fringe width is. The fringe width, interestingly enough, changes all the time, right? So what is the new intuition we get for multiphoton interference from that?
Sorry. Yeah? That's fine.
Yeah, okay. So I'm trying to move a little bit on. So here is a picture. You have the initial state and the final state as an orbit, and they enclose a phase. So what you see as quantum interference actually in the phase dependence is the enclosed phase. Yeah? So that is a very important insight from everything I told you before. We can actually understand quantum interference in a way that doesn't depend on states, right? But instead on dynamics. Yeah? We have replaced a lot of the physical properties of states with an understanding of the physical dynamics. So we need dynamic orbits. The understanding of dynamic orbits is better intuitively than the intuition of static reality. States are not static reality, they are rather orbits, right? And here it's a little bit going back to things I did before. I actually argued in a quantum studies paper that this is the right way to do joint probabilities. You have to just multiply the projectors. And in fact, this now adds up, saying that, well, instead of trying to understand the statistics here, we should maybe understand that this term comes from the dynamics. And then using this form, we can understand this form much better. Maybe a bit fast, but I see I have no time. this allows us to reconnect to the physics. Important message, the reality of physical systems is shaped by the dynamics. And quantum phases come from that. They describe the dynamics. We can understand them. Here is a kind of overview of the time-energy relation. I probably just make my final point and then put that back up. And yet it moves. Motion is important to science. We know that since Galilei, I guess. action phases and complex correlations are consistent with our experience. That's actually important to understand. Our experience gives us a good intuition of dynamics. Much better than it gives us an intuition of reality, if you think about it. Dynamics can be easier to understand. So that's a great opportunity how we can understand quantum mechanics better. I want to quickly mention here that I have a trilogy in five parts that actually all relates to that. Yeah, it's always necessary to have five parts to any trilogy, or seven, of course, but yeah, no, mine has five parts. With the most recent one being here, European Physical Journal, and actually from the European Physics Journal is more or less this picture. I might just put it up as the final here, and then there's room for some questions. Thank you.
Yes. I'm not sure I understood the statement that you cannot follow the motion of a particle. For example, suppose I have a quantum dot. I set electron from the left going to the quantum dot to the right. I can measure it weakly as it traverses the quantum dot, even under the barrier. And then on the right, so I can follow it more.
Yeah, the more information you get, the more you disturb. So you have a diffusive change. What you cannot measure is the undisturbed motion. That's correct. I should be more specific. You can measure disturbed motion. The more you measure, the more you disturb. But you cannot see the undisturbed motion, and that's the problem. So statements about complex probability have to do with the undisturbed motion. And you can show that these complex probabilities vanish in the evidence you see when you disturb the motion. That is the nature of dynamics in physics, the nature of quantum dynamics, which is really the fundamental nature of dynamics. So this is the problem. You cannot confuse your data, which is really bad, with a reality of the system, right? So when you look at a trace you take from one quantum dot, you cannot just pretend that you're seeing a physical property of the dot with precision. Right?
No, but then, of course, there is always a trade-off, but you can estimate to what extent you deviate from reality.
Deviate from reality? Which reality are you talking about then? I mean, you don't see the reality.
I'll tell you what reality.
Yeah?
I mean, the particle started from the left, arrived on the right, and in the middle it spent some time in the quantum dot, possibly under the barrier. So you can perform a weak measurement, which does not felt a bit much, so it's still enough to be under the barrier. I have information about the time it spends under the barrier, but this information is a bit noisy. So I can estimate the noise.
Yes.
So I can estimate how how much I deviate from that.
Yeah, and it's all consistent with that. Complex probabilities are consistent with that because the weak values are complex weak values. So this is exactly what I'm saying here. I mean, I come from the statistical analysis. I know very well. I told you before, we did the experiment. We changed the measurement strength in such an experiment, in optics, we did that, from 0 to 1, basically, from completely weak to projective. So we know that. And it is a trade-off between the two noise terms, the resolution noise and the back action noise. And you can look that up in our work. It's on optics, but that may be interesting to translate to quantum dots, actually.
I think we may just
I think what you are saying is that definitely a way to compare the Schrödinger and the Heisenberg picture. Very protective measurement. The system is an integral pair of these, don't degenerate. So you have the wave function describing that thing. And then you say, I do interact with a measuring device, they say it's happened to the projection operator on a given position or neighborhood. Then the Schrödinger picture, you say nothing has changed because that doesn't disturb the scale. The state remains all the time, and I measure the psi-sub-psi of this measurement. But you look at the same problem in the Heisenberg picture, you say I have a projection operator, which is time dependent, and it oscillates all the time, and only when you average over a long time, you get the only diagonal term, which gives you the same thing. The other, the Heisenberg picture is translated much better. Because in this kind of thing, the idea that you have some ergodic motion and the average of it is the right thing. This is the point issue, and the Schrödinger picture always misses that underlying thing which you're showing, and I'm also showing in other ways.
I completely agree with that. I was so fascinated that your approach is so similar there, and I'm going to try to incorporate the things you did a bit better, because there's also a big role of the modular values here. So I see okay, thank you. This is actually very much my picture. Also, why the Schrödinger picture is not complete, because it hides this motion, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think my job is charity at this point to say that we should consider it.